Hi, this is Jim from Safety Wars. Before we start the program, I want to make sure everyone understands that we often talk about OSHA and EPA citations, along with some other regulatory actions from other agencies, legal cases, and criminal activity. Everyone is innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Proposed fines are exactly that, and they are often litigated, reduced, or vacated. We use available public records, news accounts, and press releases. We cannot warranty or guarantee the details of any of the stories we share, since we are not directly involved with these stories, at least not most of the time. Enjoy the show.
This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
And we are here from the border of liberty and prosperity and the highway to the north. This is Safety Wars for Wednesday. Well, we're just blowing through this week. Wednesday, June 26th, 2024. How's everybody doing? I'm having a drinking problem here. Can't keep it in my mouth. All right, so we have an exciting broadcast day. I know I got some comments on the last program here. Why are you talking about clients? Blah, 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 blah. Well, you know what? The client that I was talking about, Army Corps of Engineers, is all on the public record. So nothing is classified here, nothing, you know, maybe buried. I'll give you that much, but... And I did not mention any names of individuals. Why is that? Because sovereign immunity strikes again. What good would that do? One, we're not about knocking people down here. And, you know, without giving context to everything that's going on, you really can't, no, nothing you can do about it. You have to have context. Context drives behavior. Now, something happened, something happened the other day, yesterday, where one of the, projects that I was working on, as we know, Safety Wars, aka JCP Technical Services, right behind me, we do a lot of support for warehouse builds. We're involved in a warehouse build right now in the central New Jersey for a company that you've heard of. So that's all I'm really allowed to say. And we're involved in the whole job often. One client we built about 48. This is the 48th warehouse we are in central New Jersey. Right? Warehouse number 48 we've been involved in. Pardon me. So we got to stay there the whole entire project up until startup on the warehouse, and we get to know different people here and there, and we get to sometimes work with, and that where they open up the warehouse and they start doing their thing in the warehouse, and there's still some construction that has to be done, punch list, they change their mind, hey, this doesn't look the way we thought it would, let's change this, you know, normal stuff. We're involved with the health and safety aspects. Well, weird thing happened yesterday. One of the projects we were involved in made the news. Why was that? Because it was two of the projects, actually. We know the people on site that manage safety. And you know how it is when a company goes out there and they start beating you, they treat you like you're a seal, you know, a baby seal, and they start beating you again. Well, this is going to happen. Oh, this is going to happen. Well, this is going to happen. They start banging and the whole thing. We know that. No, you got to have the six whys. And it's like, okay, the six whys is meant to be like a tool on how to manage, do an investigation. Why did you do that? It's not really meant to be formalized because that, like, pisses people off, makes them hate safety people. And it's like, well, you got to fill out the six whys. Why did you do that? Why did you do that? Why? And then before long, what happens? One, everybody hates you. Number two, you think they're going to tell you the truth when you have an attitude like that? I don't think so. my 30-some years experience here, and I'm not rubbing that in anyone's face. There's people out there with lots more experience than me in different areas. But they're going to tell you, well, you know what? You want to under the human organizational performance, behavior-based safety, you're supposed to get information because more information does not make us more stupid. It makes us smarter. And we want to have an accurate assessment of what's going on the job site and in your facility. And when you start acting that way, you start to have an adversarial safety process. Guess what? No one's going to report anything. If you're a general contractor, that's a real dangerous way of running your safety program, because this is what happens. Most states, there is a statute of limitations. I'm not an attorney. I'm not giving you legal advice of like 2 years. And what happens? 1 year, 11 months, and 2 weeks after an alleged incident happens, you get served a summons or a notice or something that says you're being sued. Now you're like, we didn't hear about this 2 years ago. And they're like, oh yeah, this happened. Here's this. They have all this proof. And they said, we reported it. They may have reported it to their supervisor. Their supervisor did not follow it up the line. And since they're a subcontractor, not your direct hire, now it's out of control. And you know that the employee can't sue the, very difficult. I don't want to say can't, but it's very difficult for an employee in the United States to sue the employer and win. There are some limited circumstances and everything. We all get that. We all get that, you know, over the top type stuff. And, you know, you have the scaffold law in New York that we're all very fond of here. One of our neighbors makes his living with the scaffold law. I said, well, how do you do that? Don't they ever go to trial? I said, they never go to trial. They always settle out of court for a ridiculous amount of money. And the ones that do go to trial, watch out. They'll get your, you know, it's along the lines of bring your checkbook with you sort of thing. Now, what ends up happening here, and I'm rambling. No, if the things in the news report that we read are true, they got a lot of balls, to say the least, to manage their safety, whether they do with their contractors. Because I tell you what, they would not put up with the stuff that's in that article from their contractors. Would not happen. Right? And I know that for a fact. They wouldn't put up with it. If we went in there and didn't report injuries, or we mismanaged an injury, right? Didn't send the person for urgent care, for an effective urgent care, didn't do the follow-up, and didn't do the workers' comp, and didn't do this, and everything else that's involved with managing an injury. If we didn't do any of that, guess what? They would crucify us. They would absolutely crucify us. And we probably end up losing our job over it. If you're a safety professional, you probably end up losing your job over it. Oh, come on, Jim. You're not being serious. Oh, I'm dead serious. Very, very, very serious when I say that. So, you know, it just makes you say, what the hell is going on here? And one of them had to do with a fall, which, you know, is pretty... which is pretty interesting, you know, that had to do with the fall. So what does it come down to is our hop messages here. No, we put on here, right? It's Wednesday. Let's hear the number three, right? Hop message number three. Broadcasting to our brothers and sisters in the occupied territory of behavior-based safety. Get out your secret decoder ring. Here is your nightly message.
Learning is vital. Learning is vital.
So how are you supposed to learn if you're coming from that situation where you're an adversarial situation? It doesn't work. Now you have to swallow your pride and say, how are we going to manage this and everything else? Now, the other day I mentioned some Supreme Court type stuff. You know, stuff in the Supreme Court and court cases, and we got the comments. Well, you're not an attorney. Okay, Great, I'm not an attorney, thank you. But I do know how to read, usually, right? Which I think most people would find that I grew up with would find that, before 10th grade at least, would find that very humorous because I always had a reading issue. And how did I solve it? Freshman year, St. Joe's been touching. You had to read 26 books freshman year. And so you read 26 books, roughly was the goal, but some of them were longer books. They gave you, so I think it eventually was like 21, 22 books, and you had to write book reports on them and everything else. And in 2 years, I was able to resolve my reading issue, even though sometimes, you know, I read stuff on the air and it's like, okay, I had the wrong idea on that one. Now, let's see if we can do a share screen on here. Oh, hold on. I got the audio hijack on. Kind of came up. Let's minimize that. And we are, hold on. Screen. And okay, there we are. Supreme Court of the United States. That should be coming up on your thing. And we're going on your screen. We're going to go through this here. Now, why am I mentioning this? When they do come out, it's only a couple of times a year, right, where they issue decisions. And here we have. You should be able to see this at home. Where so a lot of times people say things on the news. You're talking mainstream news. So we sometimes use the network news here. And no, 4 minutes they have. Now you could go and be like some of the other shows out there where they have multiple stories and everything else. Great. I try to shy away from that. Well, that really wasn't working for us. It's a different kind of program. I wanted to give commentary. So today we had a court decision come out, and we're going to read this up. All right. Supreme Court of the United States syllabus, Murthy, Surgeon General et al. Versus Missouri et al. Search, right? Under the longstanding content moderation policy, social media platforms have taken a range of actions to suppress certain categories of speech, including speech they judge to be false or misleading. In 2020, with the outbreak of the COVID-19, the platforms announced that they would enforce these policies against users who post false or misleading content about the pandemic. Platforms also applied misinformation policies during the 2020 election season. During that period, various federal officials regularly spoke with platforms about COVID-19 and election-related misinformation. They laid out a couple of examples here where they were, don't do misinformation and do not address misinformation. Then you had the FBI and Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency communicated with platforms about election-related misinformation. Like the Hunter Biden laptop, which has been proven to be not Russian disinformation, but true. And I told you that here on this program because I happen to have done business with the guy who reported the laptop. All right? And I knew him for a time being, and I have attendance, and I heard him on a couple of interviews, not on this network, that were very convincing to me that he wasn't a Russian spy, number one. Number two is that a very dear friend on this show, who has been on this show, knew the man personally until all this stuff went down and he had to move away. He's living somewhere, my understanding, in Colorado under an assumed name, that sort of thing, because people were threatening to kill him over it. But no, now that's proven true, basically. That laptop is thing. Right, so they were going after him, misinformation. And we had to hear about Russia collusion, which also known, right, was a lie, and everything else. So And there was also been allegations, a lot of proof, that the FBI was involved in tampering with the election and intimidation and things of that nature with this. Evidence. I mean, this is all out in the open. Now, right? So they actually went after and influenced this stuff. But that's not really relevant here for the whole thing. Respondents are 2 states and 5 individual social media users who sued dozens of executive branch officials and agencies alleging that the government pressured the platform to censor their speech in violation of the First Amendment. Following extensive discovery, the district court issued a preliminary injunction. The Fifth Circuit affirmed in part and reversed in part. The court held that both the state plaintiffs and the individual plaintiffs had Article III standing to seek injunction relief. On the merits, the court held that the government entities and officials, by coercing or significantly encouraging the platform's moderation decisions, transformed these decisions into state actions. The court then modified the district's injunction to say that the defendants shall not coerce or significantly encourage social media platforms to suppress. Held, neither the individual or the state plaintiffs have established standing, meaning they're not personally impacted here. So that's long and short of it. So they were issued, they have no standing. This is being played that courts can now go, and the practical effect, courts has said it's okay for the government to go and do X, Y, and Z and impact all this stuff. That's not what they said, according to this. In effect, that's what's going to happen. But, right, and guess what? If Donald Trump wins, who's to say, or in 2028, someone else wins, that this can't go against on the other side here? The court did not say that the government's allowed to do this. What they said was nobody had standing to do it. That's what the Supreme Court said. All right, meaning that you're not personally impacted, and an old attorney could go and explain that better than I could here. So, again, just by the bias omission, the one kind of bias, which is omission, the Supreme Court said it's fine. No, they did not say it was fine. They said nobody has standing in this. Which, in effect, the government's going to do whatever they want. Now, I have a problem here with this, personally. Maybe you got a problem with this. Do you think that it's right for the White House to give someone a call and say, knock it off, or say, hey, you don't want to do this? Especially when there's been accusations by one segment that this is weaponizing government in some ways, right? I don't know. Whatever the hell that means, does lead us down a good path. Now, there were some other, what else? That basically, there is no standing. You can go look up look it up here. So let's get down to the end. That's what they say. Right, all of the stuff, why they have standing here, right? And, boom, here it is. The plaintiff's counter-arguments are unpersuasive. First, they argue they suffer continuing present adverse effects from their past restrictions, as they must now self-censor on social media. But the plaintiffs cannot manufacture standing merely by inflicting harm on themselves based on their fears of hypothetical future harm that is not certainly impending. Second, the plaintiffs suggest that the platforms continue to suppress their speech according to policies initially adopted under government pressure. But the plaintiffs have redressability of the problem. Without evidence of continued pressure from the defendants, platforms remain free to enforce or not enforce their policies. In other words, they are, even though it's tainted by initial government coercion, that means that they're private platforms. That's more significant than anything else. They're private platforms, they can do whatever the hell they want. And the available evidence indicates that platforms that continue to enforce their policies against what COVID-19 misinformation, right? Even as the federal government has wound down its own pandemic response measures. Okay, let's put this where is this? Where the platforms, right, have continued to enforce their policies against COVID-19 misinformation. Well, some of the stuff out there that was deemed misinformation during the pandemic is not anymore. Yes, that is true. All right. The plaintiffs next assert a right to listen through your understanding. The individual plaintiffs argue the First Amendment protects their interest in reading and engaging with the content of other speakers on social media. This theory is certainly broad, as it would grant all social media users the right to sue over someone else's censorship, at least so long as they complain. They claim an interest in that person's speech. While the court has recognized the First Amendment right to receive information and ideas, the court has identified a cognizable injury only where the listener has concrete specific connection to the speaker. There's a certain case here, right? Attempting to satisfy this requirement, the plaintiffs emphasize that hearing unfettered speech on social media is critical to their work as scientists, pundits, and activists, but they do not point to any specific instance of content moderation that caused them identifiable harm. They have therefore failed to establish an injury that is sufficiently concrete and particularized. The same plaintiffs assert a sovereign interest in hearing from their citizens on social media, but they have not identified any specific speakers or topics that they have been unable to hear or follow. And states do not have third parties standing as parens patrie, right, to bring an action against the federal government on behalf of their citizens who have faced social media restrictions. And who did this? Justice Barrett delivered the opinion of the court. Justice Roberts and Sotomayor, Kagan, Kavanaugh, and Jackson joined. Alito, they were saying yes. Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch, all justices, filed a dissenting motion in which Thomas and Gorsuch, JJ, joined. Let's scroll on down here. And here's the really in-depth thing right here. That's the abstract. Let's scroll on down and see if we have an abstract for the other one. You can read through this like 57 pages. I don't normally read every piece here. And this is the dissenting opinion here. All right. The lower court's assessment of all of this record is correct, right? Going on. Rather extensive. But they basically said that they don't agree with that. Where do we get to the final conclusion here? They go into some of the other stuff here with a dissenting opinion. It's like 30 pages. Here we go. I begin with the authority of relevant officials, high-ranking White House officials, and Surgeon General high-ranking White House officials presumably speak and may have the ability to influence the president, as discussed earlier. A presidential administration has the power to inflict potentially fatal damage to social media platforms like Facebook. Facebook appreciates that what the White House could do, and President Biden has spoken openly about that power, as he has every right to do. For instance, he has declared that the policy of his administration is to enforce the antitrust laws to meet challenges posed by the rise of the dominant internet platforms. And he has directed the Attorney General and other agencies, heads, to enforce antitrust laws vigorously. Promoting competition in the American economy, Executive Order 14036, he has also floated the idea of amending or repealing of the Communications Decency Act. Right?
Previous administrations have also wielded significant power over Facebook. In a data privacy case brought jointly by the DOJ and FTC, Facebook was required to pay an unprecedented $5 billion civil penalty, which is among the largest civil penalties ever obtained by the federal government. A matter that may well have been prominent in Facebook's thinking during the period in question is this case was a dispute between the U.S. and the European Union over international data transfers. In 2020, the court addresses of the European Union invalidated the mechanism for transferring data between the EU and U.S. because it not sufficiently protect EU citizens from federal government surveillance. The EU-US conflict over data privacy hindered Facebook's international operations, but Facebook could not resolve the conflict on its own. Rather, the platform relied on the White House to negotiate an agreement that would preserve its ability to maintain its transatlantic operations. It is therefore beyond any serious dispute that top-ranking White House officials and the Surgeon General possess the authority to exert enormous coercive presence. So basically, this goes on and on and on. Basically, they said this is all baloney, what the majority said. They did have standing. Now, just the way it is, guys. Here. With that. And I'm going to continue to talk about things that interest me. And what annoys me is, we have more power right here in that smartphone. We have more access to information than probably any library ever constructed, even the Library of Alexandria in ancient Egypt. Why aren't we using that information? Why aren't we using that computing power? All right, I came across an article today about how people are getting stupider with the advent of technology. They can't read a map. And one of these things go down, what are we going to do? And, we're going to continue to, we're going to continue to read stuff that nobody else wants to talk about. Talk about stuff no one wants to talk about here on Safety Wars. Our second article from the Supreme Court is right here. Hold on. I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to go to commercial break. And we'll go from there. All right. Okay, hold on.
Have you listened or watched the Safety War show? It does stream live on the radio and on the streamer emers that we have. So if you have not taken a listen to Jim Bozell and what the hell he's doing every evening with Safety Wars, I would strongly encourage you to take a view or take a listen, whichever option is available for you, and take a listen to what the hell he has going on. It's definitely, it will take some deep dives in some information that you might be interested in.
In a world where danger lurks in every corner, one man stands as a beacon of hope. Jim Polzel, a veteran safety expert with over 3 decades of experience, now bringing his knowledge to you with Safety Wars. Engaging, informative, and always relevant, that's Safety Wars. Join the safety revolution with Safety Wars, available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and wherever you get your podcasts and videos.
OSHA recordables, catastrophic losses, environmental disasters. You want answers? So do I. This is Jim Polzel with Safety Wars.
That's my daddy!
All right, we're going to go, and another case here. All right, why don't we talk about this, about Safety Wars? The access to good information is critical for us to do our jobs as safety professionals. It's just the way it is, right? So That's why this impacts us. Now, this is a little bit here, right? Federal and state law distinguish. This is another court, Snyder versus United States. Federal and state law distinguish between two kinds of payments the public officials. Bribes and gratuities. Bribes are payments made or agreed to before an official act in order to influence the public official respect to that future official act. Gratuities are typically payments made to a public official after an official act as a reward or token of appreciation. While American law generally treats bribes as inherently corrupt and unlawful, the law's treatment of gratuities is more nuanced. Some gratuities may be innocuous, and others may raise ethical and appearance concerns. Yeah, this is like the pot calling the kettle black here, right? Federal, state, and local governments have drawn different lines on which gratuities and gifts are acceptable and which are not. For example, Congress has established comprehensive prohibitions about bribes and gratuities to federal officials. Federal official, right? So, for example, for a bribe, you have a 15-year maximum prison sentence, a prohibited gratuity, and you have a 2-year maximum prison sentence. And this goes on a little bit more into the history of this. This case involves James Snyder, who is the former mayor of Portage, Indiana. 2013, Snyder was a mayor. Portage awarded two contracts to a local trucking company. Not important which one. In 2014, Peterbilt cut a $13,000 check to Snyder. The FBI and federal prosecutors suspected the payment was a gratuity for the city's trash contract, but Snyder said that the payment was for his consulting services as a contractor for Peterbilt. Federal jury ultimately convicted him as an illegal thing and sentenced him to 1 year, 9 months in prison. On appeal, Snyder argued that the relevant statute number 666, criminalizes only bribes, not gratuities. The Seventh Circuit didn't agree and affirmed it. So this is held. Section 666 prescribes bribes to state and local officials, does not make it a crime for those officials who accept gratuities for their past acts. And they lay out a whole bunch of reasons here. Six reasons taken together lead the court to conclude that the statute that he was convicted under is a bribery statute and not a gratuity statute. Right? And it goes on and on and on. And it lists all the reasons there. By the way, if you hear an alarm, we're having a thunderstorm come through. So if we get knocked off the air, we'll see it on Friday. And, faced with a phalanx of difficulties with its interpretation of 666, the government's argument boils down to one main point, that 666 uses the term rewarded as well as influenced. The government says that Congress would not have added the term rewarded to influenced in 666 if the statute were meant to cover only bribes and not also gratuities. That argument is misconceived. Contrary to the premise of the government's argument, bribery statutes sometimes use the word reward. Moreover, without the term reward in the statute, an official might try to defend against bribery charges by saying the payment was received only after the official act, therefore it could not have influenced the act. By including the word rewarded, Congress made it clear the timing of the agreement is key, not the timing of the payment. Right? Although a gratuity or reward offered and accepted by a state or local official may be unethical or illegal under other federal, state, and local stat laws, the gratuity does not violate the specific thing. So everything got overturned for this mayor here, and this mayor, Snyder. Long road here that he went through with this. So that's the other one. So, he got off on a technicality. He took it all the way to the Supreme Court. He won his case. You got to admire a man for doing that, or a person for doing that with that. And as I like to say, and I remind my beloved bride, right, there was a case here and locally here with having to deal with a group of people who got denied gun permits in Westchester County. And I said, I think they done mess with the wrong people there. That was in 2009, and guess what? All the gun laws, a lot of them were overturned because they fought it to took it to the Supreme Court. So, suggestion, all right? No, and it's an old movie line from Clint Eastwood. I think it was Clint Eastwood to say that. Did your mama ever tell you that there were people that you shouldn't mess with? Yeah, well, I'm one of those people. And that's the moral of the story here. You know, you just don't mess with certain people. You just leave them alone. Now, coming down here. All right, we're going to go through our regular OSHA stuff here in a minute. And we're going to go, since we're not going to be on the air, we'll use our hop message number 4. This is Safety Wars, broadcasting to our brothers and sisters in the occupied territory of behavior-based safety. Get out your secret decoder ring. Here is your nightly message.
Context drives behavior. Context drives behavior.
All right, so we're going into our own, our usual stuff here. Let's see. Can we do the entire screen? No, I just want that one. And here. All right, Department of Labor begins debt collection against an Ohio landscaping company barred from federal worker program after owner allegedly threatened workers. The company was ordered to pay $169,000 in wages and penalties. U.S. Department of Labor has initiated debt collection procedures against a landscaping company that allegedly threatened workers for cooperating with a federal investigation of how the company and its owner owes a lot of money because of back wages. The action follows a wage and hour division investigation, which identified numerous violations in the H-2B visa program by a company and the owner of the company, that's named after the company. The division found the employer shorted wages for at least 19 workers by up to $4.05 per hour, less than the required prevailing wage. The company also violated program regulations by assigning workers to Pennsylvania job sites after its H-2B application certified that they would only employ the workers primarily from Mexico and the Cleveland area. The H-2B program allows U.S. employers to hire non-immigrant workers temporarily to perform non-agricultural labor services in its application. They violated for 5 years, and the company continues, this is a quote, the company continues to ignore communications from federal investigators and refuses to pay these employees back wages owed for their hard work. Those who believe they can ignore the law, continue to withhold wages, and avoid penalties are deeply mistaken and will be held accountable. And they went, the way it is. I mean, you know, pay people what you owe them. Because when you don't, it's only bad things can happen. U.S. Department of Labor announces 8 additions to program assistance transitioning service members and spouses. U.S. Department of Labor today announced the selection of 8 employment navigator and partnership program partners in the department's Veterans Employment and Training Service. And they list the companies here. We're not going to list them here on the air. Operating at 37 U.S. and overseas Air Force, Army, Coast Guard, Marine Corps, and Navy installations. They forgot Space Force, people. Employment navigators provide transitioning service members and their spouses with individualized career assistance, which can include apprentice opportunities, training, digital matching of skills and experiences, employment, networking, mentoring, and referrals, and many other services. I tell you what, the veterans need help. Here, this hits near and dear to the Pozole family here on assistance to veterans. Okay, Department of Labor completed impact inspections at 15 mines with histories of repeated health and safety violations in May 2024. The U.S. Department of Labor announced today that its Mines Safety and Health Administration, MSHA, completed impact inspections in May 2024 at 15 mines in 12 states, leading to the agency to cite 300 violations and 1 safeguard. And, you know, it gives the history here. They're talking about the upper Big Branch mine killing 29 workers. Uh, Let's see what they were. Can they link us where they are? Ooh, I think I might have to zoom in on this one. Okay. I don't even know how to read some of these. So they list them here with this land. And these are in the violations here. Hold on. Anything of note? Well, they give the breakdown, which is good. To be honest with you, I wish... no, I don't know if OSHA wow, this is pretty interesting from the MSHA here. They give out all of the, like a spreadsheet here is what we're looking at, where all the violations were and what they were. Pretty handy. Imagine if OSHA did that, if only by region. That would be great. And let's go over to our next one, the U.S. Department of Labor. Okay, U.S. Department of Labor cites contractor for lacking required fall protection that contributed to a 54-year-old employee's fatal flaw. A five-man crew's first day working to remove tar and stone from metal roof panels at a Macon warehouse outside of Atlanta, I guess, ended up roughly in November 2023 when a 54-year-old laborer tragically suffered fatal injuries after stepping on a skylight and falling about 19 feet. I've had to investigate one of these. It's not a pretty thing. And the one that I investigated on, the 19-year-old kid fell about the same height. The only thing, and what happened was, if it would have been me under the same circumstances, I would have been dead. But because he was 19 and very resilient, and the other thing was that he fell literally in front of an EMT, an off-duty EMT. And the off-duty EMT said to his threw keys to one of the workers and said, go to my truck and get the shit and call 911 in that case, right? So they're able to get immediate medical attention. The person survived, screwing him up for the rest of his life. I mean, but he survived. Investigators with OSHA determined the employee of a certain company stepped on the skylight after dumping debris off the warehouse's roof. The ambulance rushed the worker who suffered severe injuries. Yeah, well, he died, obviously severe. To a nearby hospital where they succumbed to injuries hours later. The company failed to notify OSHA of the incident within the required 8 hours. Now, often, this is what we'll see how much they whacked them for here. Now, in the heat of the moment and being this upset, I mean, I think of the Alec Baldwin and the Rust set, with how upset Alec Baldwin was during that whole thing. Things aren't going through your head exactly. This is why you have, exactly at the time, this is why you have to have, and I hate to say this, you have to have an emergency action plan, EAP, that has the information how to respond to an emergency, including a fatality. You have to have that. Why? Because you're not going to be thinking, call OSHA, especially if you have a heart. Oh, maybe I should call OSHA. The other thing that gets this, often companies that get this type of citation, I'm not saying this is actually what happened here, but no, I'm trying to add a little bit of context with things that I've seen already. A company goes out there and has this sort of thing. No, they think that because the police or the ambulance or the government was already knowing about this, that doesn't count. You have to call OSHA yourself. After more than 20 years of experience as a roofing and framing contractor, the company should know the work its employees do is dangerous and potentially fatal, especially when safety protocols are ignored, said OSHA Area Director Joshua Turner in Atlanta. Falls are widely known as the leading cause of death in the construction industry, and had required fall protections been in place in this case, a worker's family, friends, and co-workers would not be left now to grieve a terrible loss. 9 serious violations. So let's go through here. Do we have this? How about 61? Okay. A person died. Now let's... No. Jim, you shouldn't criticize. Oh, okay. They have their own rationale on why they have proposed things based on size of the company, seriousness, and everything else. But OSHA proposed $61,065 in penalties. So this goes against the thing where, you know, where companies are small mom-and-pop operations, which this apparently might have been, right? They want compliance, right, not punishment. And when you get, right, that's why these penalties are low, number one. Number two is this. Often, I'm told by people who are much more experienced than I am, that often these OSHA cases, OSHA, no, where fatalities happen, they lowball, OSHA lowballs this stuff, right, to get an admission of guilt. That could be used in a civil case. That might be part of the reason here. So I don't know what the context is, so I can't really say for sure. But that, you know, typically that happens, about 65,000, you know, it's... Especially if they're guilty of what they're accused from. I'm not saying they are guilty, you know. Everyone's innocent until proven guilty. Citation 1, item 1, serious. The employer's, on or about July, January 29th, the employer exposed employees to 18-foot, 8-inch fall hazards, and that the employees were allowed to work from a pallet elevated by a forklift, $4,800. It's a general duty clause violation, right? And, no, so as is, customary for a general duty clause thing, they have to, right, one, that the employee was exposed, two, that it was something that would cause death or a serious physical harm, and three, that there was a way of feasibly doing something and it would have been effective. Basically, there's four conditions. I think those are the four. But anyway, okay, I'll look it up for all of you folks here, because I used to have that right here. So here. Hold on, let's go. I'm going to look this up right now, and we're going to go stop sharing screen, because God knows, right? God knows what comes up in these things when you don't, when you go to Google or anything, right? So you have to have four elements here, right? The employer failed to keep the workplace free of a hazard. The hazard was recognized. The hazard was causing or likely to cause death or serious physical harm. And four, there was a feasible and useful method to correct the hazard. Hard to keep all this stuff current in my mind. So the employer did not do any of that. So, again, an OSHA has to identify that in their thing, right? No safety glasses, an iron face protection, $2,700. Again, 6-foot fall protection, construction. You need some kind of fall protection. That was $4,800. And each employee working a walking surface is not protected from falling through holes, including skylights more than 6 foot above lower levels by personal fall arrest systems, blah, blah, blah. You need to have that. That's $16,131. Now, there is one of my warehouse clients, and actually there is an engineered grid that goes underneath these skylights where if someone falls through them, they land on the grid. Probably could retrofit a lot of these skylights with that. I'm just saying, again, you're relying on the employee not to walk on a skylight. That's what you're relying on. Now, is it possible that this skylight was obscured and you can recognize this as a skylight? Yes. I've been in those situations. But that's not the typical situation. So some type of guardrail is right people put up. Something like that. Again, try to eliminate an engineer out the hazard before you're going to be relying on the rule, don't walk over there, don't walk on skylights. Guess what? Worker may do it inadvertently. You know. Hierarchy of controls, right? Citation one, item six, employer did not provide a training program. You can be give us a call. $4,800. The employer exposed employees to struck by fall hazards and that the forklift training was not provided to employees operating forklifts. Engaged in roofing and framing activities, $4,800. No training. Portable ladders were used for access to an upper landing surface and the ladder side rails did not extend at least 3 feet above the lower landing. $4,800. Again, that's a work rule violation on that. You got to keep an eye on that because workers will not follow rules all the time, just the way it is. It doesn't make them evil, doesn't or anything like that, but it is, you know, in there. $4,839. Citation 1, item 10. The employer did not provide a training program for each employee using ladders and stairways when necessary. $4,839. Citation 2, item 1. The employer did not report within 8 hours the death of an employee. On or about November 20th, the employer did not report a work-related fatality of an employee to OSHA within 8 hours. And the work-related fatality was reported to OSHA on almost over 2 months later by the descendant's brother-in-law. $3,457. Right? The site visits, right? Yeah, I don't know. What were the site visits? Do they list it here? Again, that's you don't report this, and they have come out 2 weeks later, 2 months later. You're gonna have yourself a problem, guys. And I use that generically, that term. All right, you're gonna have a problem. This is out of Smyrna, New York. Inspectors with the Department of OSHA found that a company in Tennessee failed to provide workers. The worker was fatally injured, and 3 other employees with effective fall protection, right? And this was at Syracuse, New York, Smyrna, right? That's outside of Syracuse, if I'm serious, you're right. Again, did not evaluate respiratory hazards. So, and or anything else. Let's see what this says. We may end up going overtime here, folks. You can pick this up. If it works on the podcast for your Safety FM people or on the video cast when I upload this. I wasn't sure whether the video would work. We're using the new software here. And I am trying to get the hand of it, a handle on it. $83,885 in penalties. Here are the citations. Right. And again, everybody, everyone's innocent until proven guilty here, and things get vacated and reduced and everything else. So we're not saying anyone's guilty of anything. I'm just reading government reports here tonight. All right. No written program for respiratory stuff. Okay. The employer did not establish and implement those elements of a written program to ensure that any employee using a respirator voluntarily was medically able to use that respirator and that the respirator was clean, stored, and maintained. So how do you mitigate this? How do you prevent this? Give your employees training, and if it's truly voluntary use, have them sign off on Appendix C of the respirator standard saying that they've been trained and everything else that goes into it. That will help mitigate, if not prevent, this type of citation. And the other thing is, you could do air monitoring and air sampling to determine whether it's necessary to wear that. I tell you what, the industrial hygiene audit is going to be a hell of a lot less than $6,453. Because I tell you what, at this point, as I tell people, get an attorney. So here they were using a 3M half-face respirator for voluntary employees while spraying the a fiber aluminum coating without evaluating the respiratory hazards. Just to think, fiber aluminum. I've talked to people who have had lead poisoning, and I've spoken to people who've had aluminum poisoning. The most famous aluminum poisoning out there was by, who was it, Fred Bolger, was it? No. Barnaby Jones, Jed Clampett. You know, the guy who played Jed Clampett, I forget who it was. I watched that all the time. I grew up on that show, the Beverly Hillbillies. Buddy Ebsen, right. Buddy Ebsen, worst, he never recovered. He got aluminum poisoning because the original Tin Man in the Wizard of Oz movie, he got aluminum poisoning and never recovered for it. I've spoken to people who have had lead and aluminum poisoning and said lead poisoning is better any day. I don't know if that's true, but, according to them, it's horrible to overcome. Citation 1, Item 3, type of violation serious. Each employee engaged in a steel erection activity who is on a walking working surface with an unprotected side or edge of more than 15 feet above a lower level was not protected from falls by guardrails. Again, on or about 12-15-23, an employee replacing aluminum sanding seam roof was not protected from fall hazards by utilizing fall protection, exposed to falls of 23 feet. 11,292 on that. All right. Another employee not protected from fall protection, another 11,292. Third employee, 11,292. Citation 1, Item 6. This was out of the steel erection standard. Any employee engaged in a steel erection activity who is on a walking working surface with an unprotected side or edge more than 15 feet above a lower level was not protected from a fall. And citation 1, Item 7, guardrail systems and personal fall arrest systems, positioning device systems and their components did not conform to anything, right? So this is another one that's a little bit tricky. On or about 12-15-23, the site located, blah, 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 blah. Hold on. Let me see how many minutes I have left here on Safety FM. Okay. On or about 12-15, the site located, blah, blah, fall arrest systems did not conform to the criteria in the Fall Protection Center when the horizontal lifeline used by employees was not designed and sole used under the supervision of a qualified person as part of a personal fall arrest system. Here it is. When employees utilizing vertical lifelines are not attached to several lifelines, so you had them attached all to one, and multiple employees are connected to two vertical lifelines, tied around a roof end that was not capable of supporting 5,000 pounds. And again, you have to limit that fall to 6 feet. Fall arrest systems do not conform to the criteria when employees are utilizing a fall arrest system, which would allow them a free fall of 12 to 14 feet. Another 11,292. And no training, obviously, 11,292. Right? I don't know. That's where we have it here for a total of $83,885. I don't know. I don't know. I don't even know what to say here with this. I don't know. So we're going to wrap things up here with our disclaimer here and everything else. We will see you, God willing, on Friday.
This is Safety War. This is Safety.
Oh, hold on.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.